This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Maybe it really is time, as Barack Obama suggested, for us to have a national discussion on race. Maybe that time really has come. Maybe it's already happening. Maybe it's happening in ways that that may just be necessary. It may just be the necessary purge. Today, front page of USA Today, an Associated Press article found how Senator Obama's support among working, hardworking Americans, white Americans, this is quoting Hillary Clinton, is weakening again. And, well, in fact, here's the actual clip. This is Hillary Clinton talking to the Associated Press.
How does Hillary Clinton win the nomination?
Well, Kathy, you know, there was just an AP article posted that found how Senator Obama's support among hardworking
Americans?
Americans, white Americans is...
Oh, white Americans, okay.
Weakening again. And how...
Americans?
The, you know, whites in both states.
Oh, the whites, okay.
But not completed college were supporting me. And in independence, I was running even with...
So, anyway, it continues with that. And this is how USA Today actually opens this story, Kathy Kiley and Joe Lawrence, about referring to Clinton's blunt remarks about race. And the fact of the matter is, in both states, as the AP notes, Clinton won 6 of 10 white voters. And Obama spokesman Bill Burton said that in Indiana, Obama split working-class voters with Clinton and won a higher percentage of white voters than in Ohio in March. And he went on to say these statements from Senator Clinton are not true and, frankly, disappointing. So, and then over the Daily Kos weighs in, and he points out, he says, I keep hearing from all over the place that if it wasn't for those meddling blacks, Clinton would have won big yesterday. This is, you know, from his post on May 7th. And then he goes through the list. Okay, people with college degrees, regardless of race. In Indiana, 56% prefer Obama. In North Carolina, 57% for Obama. First-time primary voters, regardless of race, 69% for Obama. In Indiana, 60% in North Carolina. Independents, 54% for Obama, 45% for Obama in North Carolina. Clinton took 19%. Liberals, 56-63%. Urban, 60%-66%. White 17 to 29-year-olds, 54-57%. All 17 to 29-year-olds, 61-74%. 17 to 64-year-olds, 52-60%. So, and but there apparently is this racial divide. Toni Morrison in Time magazine this week asked, you know, do you regret referring to Bill Clinton as the first black president? She said, people misunderstand that phrase. I was deploring the way in which President Clinton was being treated vis-a-vis the sex scandal that was surrounding him. I said he was being treated like a black on the street, already guilty, already a perp. I had no idea. I have no idea what his real instincts are in terms of race. And then she went on to say that she is supporting Barack Obama in this case. Although she was inclined to support Hillary Clinton as a woman, and she doesn't diss her, and she's not putting her down or anything like this. And then Hillary yesterday, she said, what we have not been able to count on in the last elections are the voters I'm getting, she said. Women, particularly lower-income women, didn't vote for John Kerry. Hispanics didn't come out for Senator Kerry in the numbers that people had hoped for. Working people are really that base. And so are we seeing the splitting of America, or has it simply always been this way? And I would submit to you that it has always been this way, and that we really, this might be, and Hillary Clinton's blunt talk about this, frankly, I think is a healthy thing. I think that bringing this forward and saying, let's have this conversation. Barack Obama talked about it a while back. He said, we need to have a national conversation on race. This race, no pun intended, this presidential race is bringing this forward. This is something, however, that is not at all new. I mean, this goes back literally to the founding of this country. And just to share with you some thoughts, this is some of this from my book, What Would Jefferson Do? Fawn Brody, who wrote, in my opinion, the best biography of Thomas Jefferson, it's called Thomas Jefferson, An Intimate History, she said it deserves notice that his phrase, all men are born free, which appears 6 years later in the Declaration of Independence, and which has been traced with his zealous scholarship to men of the Enlightenment, first came to Jefferson's lips publicly in the legal defense of a black man when he was a private attorney. In the April of 1770, Jefferson was practicing law and defended a slave who was requesting his freedom. The case was Howell versus Nederland. And in his arguments on behalf of the slave, Jefferson said, quote, under the law of nature, all men are born free, and everyone comes into the world with a right to his own person, which includes the liberty of moving and using it at his own will. The year before that, 1769, as a legislator in Virginia, Thomas Jefferson had written a bill to abolish the importation of slavery of slaves in that state. Now, he got tremendous blowback from this. That same year, he tried to write into the Constitution of the state of Virginia a provision that would gradually but totally eliminate slavery starting in 1800. And in 1778, he proposed an even more radical bill that would have abolished slavery altogether in Virginia instantly in 1778. In 1883, he again unsuccessfully attempted to amend Virginia's Constitution, proposing language that said, quote, the General Assembly shall not permit the introduction of any more slaves to reside in this state or the continuance of slavery beyond the generation which shall be living on the 31st day of December 1800, all persons born after that day being hereby declared free. The year after that, this was in 1883, in 1884, he proposed at a national level a law banning slavery, and stating that any state admitted to the Union would have to declare that any person of any race born in that state after 1800 was a free person. That proposal, that federal proposal, lost by a single vote. But he was punished by his peers in Virginia for this, and rather severely. The Virginia Assembly passed a law that any slave freed in the state, which would have included Jefferson's slaves, had to leave the state forever and would be arrested by the state itself and sold back into slavery if they failed to leave the state. They also passed a law, and this is how the slaveholders of Virginia responded to Jefferson's attempt to amend the Virginia Constitution. They also passed a law that said that slaves who are freed and stayed in the states, could be, quote, hung, burned at the stake, dismembered, castrated, and branded, as well as the ordinary punishment of whipping, end of quote, from the law that was actually passed in response to Jefferson trying to end slavery in Virginia. So in 1883, he tried. The next year, he tried again. The year after the signing of the Declaration of Independence, Vermont, which was then a sovereign nation, modified its constitution to ban slavery. Slavery was actually outlawed in many of the states of the United States. Pennsylvania passed a law initiating the emancipation of slaves in 1780. New Hampshire and Massachusetts followed Vermont's lead in 1783. By that time, the process had spread to New York, New Jersey by the turn of the century, Delaware, freed their slaves, slave owners in Delaware in such large numbers that it amounted to a new abolition. By 1810, 76% of African Americans in Delaware were free. This is without laws pushing this. In Maryland, free blacks numbered a substantial 23%. They were voting in these states. So, this is something that's been around for a long time. In 1820, Missouri and Maine were admitted as states to the Union. And Congressman John Holmes of Massachusetts wrote a letter to an elderly Thomas Jefferson to inform him of what is referred to as the Missouri Compromise. And this was on April 22nd, 1820, just 6 years before his death. And I want to share with you just a couple of paragraphs from Jefferson's letter in response to that, because I think that it is what we are seeing today and what we need to confront. We're going to take a break right now, and when we come back from this break, I'm going to share this with you, Jefferson's notion of this treason against the hopes of the world. So, Chris, you can start that break, and we'll be back. This is such an important issue, frankly. And, you know, I guarantee you the Republicans are going to be bringing this up hugely. It's something that I think that we need to be talking about. What is this? How do we address this issue? How have we addressed this issue in America? How can we reconcile this issue of racism in America? Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media.
3 hours a day.
5 days a week.
Past the hour. So here we have Thomas Jefferson, one of the Virginia slaveholders, the author of the Declaration of Independence, and we're going to talk about that in just a moment, talking about this issue of slavery, fighting against slavery through much of his early career, then essentially backing away from it. He actually thought that slavery, that the Constitution had essentially, you know, was going to phase out slavery after the early 1800s, after 1808. And he was wrong. And when the Missouri Compromise happened, the big compromise was that Missouri and Maine were both admitted as states to the Union, and there were supposed to be no more slaveholding states, but they said, okay, we'll let Maine in a non-slaveholding state. We'll let Missouri in as a slaveholding state if we let Maine in as a non-slaveholding state. This was considered a great compromise in 1820. Now, Jefferson has not been president since 1808. It's been a long time. And he's an old man. He's 6 years from dying. He's got terrible arthritis at this point. Hard for him to write. And Congressman John Holmes, who's an old friend of his, writes him this letter telling him about this. And he writes back talking about this geographical line that he sees, the Mason-Dixon line. This is basically Thomas Jefferson predicting the Civil War. He says, I thank you, dear sir, for the copy you have been so kind to send me of the letter to your constituents on the Missouri question. It is a perfect justification to them. I had for a long time ceased to read newspapers or pay any attention to public affairs, confident they are in good hands and content to be a passenger in our bark to the shore from which I am not distant. In other words, he's taking the canoe against the River Styx to his death. He says, but this momentous question, like a fire bell in the night, awakened and filled me with terror. I consider it at once as the death knell of the Union. It is hushed indeed for the moment. But this is a reprieve only, not a final sentence. A geographical line coinciding with a marked principle, moral and political. He's obviously speaking of slavery. Once conceived and held up to the angry passions of men, will never be obliterated, and every new irritation will mark it deeper and deeper. I can say with conscious truth, there is not a man on earth who would sacrifice more than I would to relieve us from this heavy reproach in any practicable way. The sensation of that kind of property, for it is so misnamed, slavery as property, is a bagatelle, this is a word meaning a small issue, a trifle, which would not cost me a second thought if in any way a general emancipation and extirpation of slavery could be effected, and gradually and with due sacrifices, I think it might be. But as it is, we have a wolf by the ears, and we can neither hold him nor safely let him go. And then he goes on to talk about how this admission of another slave state to the United States is a treason by America against the hopes of the world. He finishes his letter to John Holmes. This elderly Thomas Jefferson now writing with a cramped hand, saying, I regret that I am now to die in the belief that the useless sacrifice of themselves by the generation of 1776 to acquire self-government and happiness to their country is to be thrown away by the unwise and unworthy passions of their sons, and that my only consolation is to be that I will not live to weep over it. If they would but dispassionately weigh the blessings that they throw away against an abstract principle more likely to be affected by union than by scission, they would pause before they perpetrate this act of suicide on themselves and of treason against the hopes of the world. Thomas Jefferson, 1820, slavery. Now, it's easy in this day and age for all of us looking back 200 years ago to deplore Thomas Jefferson for slavery. I mean, the simple fact of the matter is he used the cheap labor resources of his slaves to maintain his lifestyle, and the consequence of the failure of his efforts to abolish slavery led to a bloody civil war followed by 100 years of legal apartheid. Although he rationalized his slaveholding by keeping them in a style that exceeded that of most poor whites of the day, both were grim by today's standards, it was nonetheless a rationalization of slavery. Jefferson's lifestyle was made possible by slave labor. There's no other way to say it. Recognizing that fact, many Americans are righteously indignant and quick to judge him harshly, and perhaps appropriately. But the stark reality is that in America, we didn't end slavery. We simply exported it. I mean, the sweater I'm wearing was made in Malaysia. The jeans I'm wearing were made in probably in Vietnam or China. The computer that is sitting in front of me was made in China. Slaves all over the world are now maintaining our lifestyle. And we didn't end discrimination and racism. We simply buried it or became polite about it. It really is time for us to confront both of these issues. And both of them, frankly, have been confronted head-on by the Obama campaign, and I believe that they've been confronted to a large extent head-on by the Clinton campaign as well. The Democratic Party has been at the forefront of this since Lyndon Johnson. And let's acknowledge that prior to that, the Democratic Party was, to some extent, the party in the South anyway, the party of the KKK and the party of slavery in the 1800s. But the Democratic Party for the last 50, 60 years has been the party of inclusion, the party that has been saying, hey, wait a minute, slavery in a foreign land, that's just as wrong as slavery here in the United States. Let us reexamine these so-called trade deals. And discrimination in the United States, this is wrong too. It's time for us to take a step beyond it. It's time for us to wake up and realize that we're all just people here. And I know that sounds just so new age, but it is true. How do we break through the inevitable racism, the soft racism of Ed Rendell saying, well, Pennsylvanians won't vote for a black, and the hard racism that's going to come from the Republican Party? How do we do it?
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Well, I took a walk around the world to ease my troubled mind. I left my body lying somewhere in the sands of time. But I watched the world flow to the dark side of the moon. I feel there's nothing I can do.
Just a heads up, in the second hour of our program, Don Siegelman, the former governor of Alabama, is going to be joining us. And also on Friday, May 16th at 7 p.m. in Chicago, I'll be at Frugal Muse Books. So if you want to drop by and say hi, it'd be very nice. I'll be giving a rant about my most recent book and doing a book signing there at Frugal Muse Books. That's in Darien. So on the 16th at 7 p.m. Friday night. For complete details, by the way, you can get them at WCPT820.com. So I get an email here from Dan. He says, Jefferson was a bigot, racist, known human beings his whole life, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Dan, I'm assuming that you don't own anything that was made by slaves. Come on. We are all slaveholders. The difference, he goes on, as president, he owned human beings, sold human beings, never freed any human beings, even after his friggin' death. Right. And so do you and I. The difference is that we don't have to look into the face of our slaves. And it's time for us to acknowledge that. That, Dan, you are a slaveholder too. That the prosperity of this country, and frankly the prosperity of non-slaveholding whites in the North who were so sanctimonious about slavery in the 1700s, was made possible by slavery in the South. And we just have to confront this reality rather than saying, oh, we're the good guys, they were the bad guys. This is an American problem, and not just an American problem, by the way. The British, who were so sanctimonious, were driving much of the slave trade and huge profits being made out of London, and on it goes. But bringing it back to today, How do we push through this? Now, the bad news, and this is the front page of USA Today, that more whites were voting for Hillary Clinton than for Barack Obama in Indiana and in Pennsylvania, and there are a couple of states like that. David Sirota has written about this. On the other hand, there are many states, you know, Wisconsin, Iowa, there's many states where the vast majority of the whites were voting for Barack Obama. How do we push past this issue of race in the United States? How do we confront it head on? John in Irvine, California. Hey, John. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hey, John, you're on the air.
Yes. I just want to say that the first time I've called into your show, but I listen to it all the time.
Thank you.
But anyway, I agree 100% with your comment that Lyndon Johnson did probably the most of any Democrat to promote overcoming the racism issues in the U.S.
Racial healing and reconciliation. John, we've lost your call, so I'm not sure what happened there. But yeah, in fact, Bill Moyers tells the story, I believe it's Bill Moyers, of how the legislation, the Civil Rights Act, was brought into the LBJ's office, and he was advised by one of the people standing there, President Johnson, if you sign this legislation, the Democratic Party, particularly in the South, is going to lose basically an entire generation of voters. And Lyndon Johnson said, if that's the price to pay for doing the right thing, I'm willing to do that. You know, I'm willing to hurt the Democratic Party. And he did. John in Hayward A. Oh, it's listening on Green 960, so it must be in San Francisco. Hayward, California. Hello? Hey, John, what's up?
Hello? Can you hear me?
John? Let me put in another plug, maybe. There we go. Okay, I'd lost my ISDN line. I've got a
Hello?
Funny echo, but John, what's up?
Hello? Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Yes. You mentioned about how can we stop racism and whatnot. I think one of the main things is to have accurate history and highlight the fact that the founding fathers, including Jefferson and whatnot, what a scam they were putting on over on the average white citizenry back then. This notion that blacks came from nowhere. I can't change what happened back then.
I got to tell you, John, that scam is still going on, and it's largely being directed not just to African Americans in the United States, but to Native Americans in the United States.
Right. And the thing is, see, we're keeping it going. If we would change our give accurate history now today, for instance, mentioning the fact that when Christopher Columbus came over, the navigator was black. And one reason he was black is because Africans had came to America over 1,000 years earlier. And we don't highlight that. And a lot of white
Well, and also let's acknowledge that when absolutely. But let's also acknowledge that when Christopher Columbus, and thanks, John, for your comments, that when Christopher Columbus came over, one of his major businesses when he first landed in Hispaniola, in what is now Haiti and the Dominican Republic, was the slave trade. And he wrote a letter back to the king where he was talking about how, 10 and 12-year-old girls were selling for more than the highest quality wood. The guy was involved in the slave trade and in large part in the sex slave trade. And within 50 years or within 20 or 20, 25 years, he had essentially committed a genocide against an entire people, the Tiano Indians of that continent. So it's just, anyway, John in Scottsdale, Arizona, listening on KPHX.
Hello.
Hey, John.
Hello.
Hey, what's up?
Yeah, I'm hoping I'm on. I don't know. But
you
I
are,
to,
yes.
I want to see how right you are. And I wanted to talk about Claude Dubois, which comes after Jefferson, your points, but he makes essentially the same point. But before I start, I want to direct your attention to the caucus and the New York Times and a comment made by Hillary, and you can look at it and read it at your convenience. But she's saying exactly the same thing that you're saying. But Dubois, to understand what happened with Hillary, you have to understand the Dixiecrats of the 30s and 40s, and you have to understand the tectonic plates that are embedded in the Democratic political structure. And it's specifically along the lines that you're pointing out. And it took a world war and a depression to break the shackles.
Yeah.
People do not understand. You want to solve the problem, you have to do what Huey Long, believe it or not, Huey Long from Louisiana, persuaded his constituents that we were all in the same boat.
Yeah.
And that's the problem, that the if you will.
The shift, actually, that I would submit to you, John, and if you've read W.E.B. Du Bois at length, you're more of a scholar of this than I am, because I've only read in excerpts and whatnot, but my sense of it, and certainly I'm not a scholar of Huey Long and his era, but although I'm familiar with it, but my sense of it is that what World War I and the Great Depression brought America is, and arguably you could say the Civil War began this, was a shift from overt racism to classism.
Right.
And that what we're dealing with in the United States now really is classism, and in fact it's classism that is being elevated as almost a positive thing in some ways, by the media. Oh, look at it, it's the working class whites versus the elites. And that classism is every bit as pernicious and destructive as racism.
Precisely. Please let me clarify. Du Bois stated the problem verbally and rhetorically.
Yeah.
But an example of someone who fought the problem would have been Huey Long.
Populist.
Yes, yes. But the main point of trying to drive home is there is a tectonic plate here. Hillary is absolutely right. She touched on a constituency, and she brought that constituency before, and we see in Hillary's campaign the Dixiecrat movement that we saw back in the 30s and 40s. And the way to attack that, Huey Long gives us an example. Whites must realize that essentially they are in the same boat as African Americans. Maybe they're a leg up, but that leg is a very short the leg of a midget.
Yeah, and the man is now General Electric.
Right. So thank you.
It's the transnational corporations. You're welcome. Thank you, John, for making an excellent point. I mean, it's a good one. Arnold in Texas. Hey, Arnold.
Hey, Tom. You know, what you said. We got to discuss this thing because the slavery now is the division of the United States people. Being divided on issues like this, we will never get together. As long as we don't get together to discuss these things, race relations in this country, I told your screener, is like this. We go from an instance like Rodney King to what happened with Don Imus, and then we put it to bed in our minds like we're putting a bandage on a bullet wound.
Yep.
And it always festers, and it comes back to a head later on. And we do absolutely nothing about it in this country. Black and white do absolutely nothing to further it because we put it to sleep. It's
right.
Like a sleeping
and,
giant.
And there is the, and as I said, there's also underneath that, and frankly, I think it should be in our mind above that, is the issue of class. Because the reason,
right.
I had this right-wing caller called in yesterday and said, oh, you liberals have destroyed black families by welfare because the men don't have to work, blah-de-blah. No, the reality is that African Americans in the United States don't have the multi-generational wealth which serves as the launching pad into the middle and upper middle classes
right.
that whites have. And as a consequence, when the economy gets soft because the big corporations are saying, hey, it's more profitable to manufacture things in China than it is in the United States. Let's move the decent jobs out of here. And when Reagan and friends come along, all the Republicans come along and start busting up the unions, who gets hurt first? The African-Americans, the people who have not, by and large, aggregated that cultural wealth. And it's not... historically it was a racial issue, but increasingly it's becoming a class issue in among both races, frankly, among all of the races.
Exactly, Tom, exactly. You know, we don't want reparations for what happened 200 years ago in slavery. Why not apologize and do something about the 100 years after Lincoln freed us in 1865 up until 1965, we went through the maze of Jim Crow.
Yeah, no, Arnold, spot on. And speaking of reparations, I mean, we need to clean up our act now over what's going on today. 45 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in the People's Republic of Little Beirut, as George Sr. referred to Portland, Oregon. Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman Program, powered in part by Teamsters for Change. It is time for change in Washington, D.C. You can learn more about it by going to Teamster.com. Teamsters.org. And we're proud and honored to be sponsored by the Teamsters, by a union-sponsored show here. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Gary in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Gary.
Oh, hi, Tom. I was thinking about racism and ageism and sexism, and I think that the essence of that is the denial of a person's individuality. When you deny them their individuality, you're not granting them their full humanity, and then if they don't have their humanity, you don't have to worry about their human rights.
Yeah.
So I think it's just, the thing is just to see people as people, not as a member of this group or that group or this gender or that gender.
Here's another example of it. I don't know what you would call this, perhaps Iraqism, but you know, we have killed 100,000 people.
That's displaced
racism. 4 million people in Iraq. Yeah, it is a variety of racism, just as it was in Vietnam when we referred to Vietnamese by racist names.
Yeah.
And now we're referring to Iraqis by racist names.
They don't count.
See, it's a two-step. And the first part of this is what people have to understand. The first part of the two-step is actually a healthy human impulse that we not only can't get rid of, but shouldn't. The first part is my first priority is my family.
Yeah.
My first priority is my wife, my children, my parents, my brothers, my sister, my immediate family. My second priority is my immediate community. And then after that, you know, my third priority is the rest of the world. That's the human instinct. That is a perfectly, you know, a perfectly normal and healthy thing, Gary. And what happens then is that some people say, yeah, and the whole world is part of me, and I am part of humanity and involved in it. And what was it, Walt Whitman or whatever? No, it was John Donne, you know, and is For Whom the Bell Tolls. But when it becomes the ism, is when people say, you know, it's me, it's my community, it's my family, and those other people who look different than me or live in a different place than I do or speak differently than I do or have a different religion than I do or have a different gender or a different age, whatever it may be, all those isms, that they are not quite as human as I am. That's when it becomes toxic. That's when it becomes sick. And I'm telling you, and even classism, oh, those people who make far more money or far less money, oh, they're not quite as human as I am. They're not quite as important. Their feelings don't matter as much. That's when it becomes the ism. That's when it becomes destructive. And we have to acknowledge that there are two pieces to this. There is the natural human impulse that's never going to go away. And then there's the twisting of that impulse, typically by others for political or economic advantage. That is used to divide us one from the other. The Republican Party has been massive. This is Richard Nixon's Southern strategy. Divide Democrats from each other. Divide people from each other, according to lines of race and class and gender and everything else. So that's what it's all about. Kim in San Francisco, listening on K-Green.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Kim.
Here's the way I feel. It's not about race. It is not about gender. As you said, it is not about the isms. It is about class to a certain degree, but most importantly, if you look at the history of this nation, it's about cheap labor.
Yep.
Until we see past all these isms, we will never make the changes. Until we unite and join each other and hold each other's hands and fight together, we will never make a change in this country. This country, in fact, slavery was as much a battle over cheap labor as it was anything else, because
Absolutely.
It was cattle. They viewed it as cattle that you bought, and it was self-propagating.
Kim, if I may interrupt you, it even is today in these conservatives who we've had on this program who are saying that a woman's place is in the home where the labor is free.
It is free labor. It is not given a penny by government. It doesn't cost anybody anything, and that goes for men that stay at home as well.
Yeah.
But the thing is, you know, Tom, when I was also a Teamster some time ago, and I was looking at labor, and I found a picture in a book in a library, and I will never forget it because it was, I guess it was in the 30s or something, and it was a picture of black men and white men running through a field, obviously victorious. Behind them was a plant, and the caption below it was, now this is before there were any real good moves on civil rights.
Mm-hmm.
They were jumping, obviously jubilant, obviously victorious, and the caption below it said, they had just won a union election.
Right.
The thing that will unite us is when we recognize the similarities that we all have. Stop the isms. Hey, I feel that there's a good cause for sexism in this election, but I
yep.
don't care. It doesn't matter until we see the big picture. We ain't going to change nothing.
Very well said, Kim. Thank you very much. Excellent. And so true. And, that, and my point about, by the way, the cheap, you know, your cheap labor conservatives and the folks at home. In most of Western Europe, and certainly in all the Scandinavian countries, if you stay at home and watch the children, as it were, and are a homemaker, it is as if you had a salary. You earn Social Security. And you know, geez, let's be honest about, you know, this is labor, too, here in the United States. And by the way, let me just add, I have been noticing a mind-numbing number of ads, particularly on the cable shows, for this literally billion-dollar industry of busting unions in the United States. This is about classism. This is about trying to destroy the working people in the United States. Mark in Detroit. Hey, Mark, just about a minute here before we got to wrap up this hour.
I'll try to make it real quick. I think what your last caller, that's an element of how we can sort of cure this disease. Mm-hmm. It's always amazed me how poor whites and blacks, especially during slave times, after pitted against each other when it's actually the slave owners that poor whites should have been mad at.
Yep.
My other thing that I want to state is I think that poor whites in particular, I think white people need to have a forum. It needs to be televised on C-SPAN or something so that the intellectuals can talk about white supremacy, the images that you see on TV, because too much of whiteness is reinforced as being superior in this country. And especially,
yeah.
I think it affects poor white people because that's all they can cling to.
You're right, Mark. And that's the subtext to it, and it always has been. Thank you very much for the call. I've got to move along. Don Siegelman, governor of Alabama, coming up next.
You're in the Democracy Zone.
Democracy
with
Zone.
Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program. Program. Welcome to the vast, radical, middle conspiracy. Accept no imitations. Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. I have been saying for a long time with regard to the Bush administration, don't look at the prosecutors who were fired. Look at the ones who kept their jobs. Don't look at the anomalies, at the scandals. Look at the stuff that's being buried. Look at the, if you could, look at the 5 million emails in the White House that have been deleted. The evidence of the ongoing crimes that's being covered up. Look at the prosecution of former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman, for example, who is with us as a guest this hour. He'll be taking your calls at 866-303-2270 after we've had an opportunity to discuss a couple of topics here that I'd like to get into with him. Governor Siegelman, welcome back to our program.
Oh, Tom, thank you. I loved your introduction about, you know, if we could just dig up those 5 million emails that have been erased and destroyed. You know, I think I said on the last program, I believe Karl Rove learned two things from Watergate. One, he learned that you don't have to create a secret plumber's unit in the White House when you've got the Department of Justice and the U.S. attorneys to do the job for you. And then secondly, you don't leave around tapes like Nixon did. You destroy evidence. And I think that's exactly what has happened in this administration. And, you know, Congress, I don't know anywhere else to turn. I think the only place we have to go is to the House and Senate Judiciary Committees, asking them to dig in and to find the truth.
Yeah. In fact, I would say that this was the lesson of Watergate that was learned even by the Bush senior administration, where you had Ollie North shredding documents like there was no tomorrow. But these guys have turned it into an art form. Let's just recap for our listeners who may not be familiar with the situation or may just be tuning in or may not have heard our previous conversation, Governor. What happened with you from, you know, if you can kind of give us the elevator speech here in a couple of minutes from the election, you were the sitting governor of Alabama through today, if you don't mind, just recap.
I ran headlong into Karl Rove and did battle with him in Alabama. He made Alabama his second home after being, chased out of Texas when he lost the 92 race. And in 1998, I ran for governor, and Karl Rove was running both the George W.'s campaign and a campaign for attorney general in Alabama. Shortly after I endorsed Al Gore, a state investigation was started by Karl Rove's client. In 2001, a federal investigation was opened by the wife of Karl Rove's business associate and political partner, Bill Canary. His wife was the U.S. attorney who ultimately brought charges and prosecuted me. The 2002 election was electronically manipulated. I won the night of the election, woke up the next morning, the votes had been electronically shifted to my opponent. And the two people given credit, one was Karl Rove's partner, and the other was a person who went to work for a Jack Abramoff, Tom DeLay-related company. But throughout this, there are multiple scenes where Karl Rove's fingerprints are on this case, are involved in this prosecution, or are involved in efforts to defeat me or to defeat my lottery using Jack Abramoff and Indian casino money, Ralph Reed, and other friends of Karl Rove, such as Grover Norquist. So there's just multiple opportunities. If we had a video camera at that time of having Karl Rove at the scene of the crime, and we are now faced with a criminal conviction where I was raising money for the Alabama Education Lottery referendum in 1999. At the same time, Rove's bagman, Jack Abramoff, was running casino money from Mississippi and Louisiana into Alabama to defeat the lottery.
Right.
I was investigated. He and his cronies were not. I was convicted of a bribery charge, which in our brief on appeal we allege was primarily caused by a wrongful instruction of the judge. And, of course, 60 Minutes said that the conviction also came about as a result of the prosecutors using false testimony from a witness.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of where we stand now.
Right. So, you're asserting that you're not guilty of bribery. And, in fact, it seems that the charge was based on, it's not uncommon, for example, for the president to appoint people to ambassadorships who have donated to his campaign. In this case, this individual you appointed to a hospital board who had been on a hospital board before, it was an unpaid position, and he had not contributed to your campaign. He had contributed to this campaign for a lottery to fund higher education that you were supportive of.
That's true. And he had also been appointed to this same board by two Republicans and one other governor, three governors prior to me,
right.
Two Republicans and one Democrat. So we feel good that the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals will look at the facts and will say, as you did, that this is no different than the political practices that go on in every state and of course, by the President of the United States in appointing people who have contributed to their campaigns.
Right.
As long as there's not an agreement to swap government action or positions in exchange for the money, then there's no crime committed. And of course, there was no evidence of that in this case. And
now, in your case, after you were convicted, you were shackled and let out of court. I mean, typically with a white-collar crime, if a person is convicted, they're allowed, 45, Martha Stewart, you've got 45 days on bail to prepare to go to jail or to prepare an appeal or whatever. They just hauled you off, started moving you around, kept you incommunicado, locked you down.
It was a shock to all of us, I think, and it was a shock to the public that someone would be treated that way. But I think that was part of the plan all along, and something that the prosecutors wanted, and something that the judge went along with. And looking back on it, I think it probably helped open the eyes of the people in Alabama and perhaps throughout the country to the fact that something was going on here that shouldn't be going on.
Yeah. Do you think that this was payback from Karl Rove, just viciously punishing a political opponent, or was this a way of silencing you so that your story wouldn't be in the press, or both?
Well, I think it was more of getting me out of the spotlight. I was also given an additional 3 years in prison because I spoke out on the courthouse steps explaining Karl Rove's involvement in this prosecution. And the judge in sentencing, I added about 3 years onto my sentence for speaking my mind about the how the executive branch was involved in this prosecution.
Yeah.
As we can see now from the investigation that's going on by the House Judiciary Committee, we now know that there is evidence of Karl Rove's involvement in this prosecution. So we're also hopeful that the 11th Circuit will note that and will strike that from the judge's order as well.
I'm curious, Scott Block, who is was, you know, just his offices were raided, the Office of Special Counsel, apparently had an open investigation into what happened to you, and that investigation, at least the OSC task force, is a task force within his office, was supposed to be investigating this, and he stopped that investigation. Are you familiar with this?
I am. I'm sure I read the same AP report that and other newspaper reports that you're referring to. But what was interesting was that the task force started this undisclosed investigation back in September of last year, and then decided that they needed to get documents from the Department of Justice, and so they were planning to request those documents at the time this investigation was slammed shut. And it was interesting that the special counsel said that to continue this would be a breach, and I'm not sure what he meant by that. And I'm also curious as to what documents that the task force was seeking from the Department of Justice.
Right.
You know, we have also been seeking documents from the Department of Justice. My legal team has, and which would examine the conflicts of interest between the prosecutor's husband and Karl Rove and myself. We've also sought information relating to Jack Abramoff's involvement in the Indian casino money and other documents relating to campaign contributions.
We have to take a break, sir. We'll get back with that, and I just want to wrap this up with Scott Block. I'm also curious about your prosecution of ExxonMobil. And then we'll take calls from our listeners for you. We're talking with Governor Don Siegelman of Alabama, former governor, 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Fire it up, fire it up. We push off, we are rolling boulders, crashing down the mirrored stairways to a blast.
So here we have the office that is supposed to be protecting whistleblowers, saying, let's look into the Siegelman situation. And then Scott Block, the head guy, the political appointee, says, no, wait a minute, we're not going to do that. And now Block is under investigation. This is getting very, very convoluted. We'll see where that all leads. We have Governor Don Siegelman on the line with us, the former governor of Alabama, who believes that the election was stolen from him, and in part, I don't want to characterize your position, Governor, on this. I'm curious. There was an article in Harper's back in 2007 that suggested that pointed to your launching a complaint against ExxonMobil for fraud that caused a jury to award a judgment against ExxonMobil of $3.6 billion. The ExxonMobil appealed, and the appeals court, the state high court, handed down an 8-1 vote in favor of ExxonMobil, reduced the damages down to $51.9 million. And of the nine members of that court, eight of them were Republicans. One was a Democrat. This is a court that is elected partisanly. And every single one of the Republicans sided with ExxonMobil. The one Democrat sided with you. And the article in Harper's points out, over the last 15 years, judicial elections in Alabama have been increasingly polarized, with enormous sums of money entering the state from the national business community in an effort to seize control of the state's courts. This money was largely channeled by the Chamber of Commerce and entities controlled by it, and by the Business Council of Alabama, run by William Canary, whose wife prosecuted you. Is there, and he's also the campaign partner of Karl Rove, is there something here that we should know about, Governor?
Well, I think it's all, Tom, I think it's all interconnected. I want to just jump back to the raid on the special counsel for just a minute. But
sure.
What we're seeing here is a pattern of where the government is blocking every attempt to get the records of not only this case, but other records that would reflect how Karl Rove hijacked the Department of Justice and has used it as a political tool. And, you know, whether it's our attempt to get the records or the House Judiciary's effort to get those same records from DOJ, or whether it's the special counsel's task force efforts to get records from DOJ, we are being shut down at every turn. We're being blocked from getting those records. And as you pointed out at the beginning of the show, they've erased all the emails. So I think there is a pattern here that needs to be explored by the House Judiciary Committee. Back to your question on Exxon, I brought two important cases, one against Big Tobacco. When I was lieutenant governor, I filed a taxpayer's lawsuit along with the other of attorneys general around the country. I was a former attorney general, so I joined in with them and brought Alabama into the case against the recommendation of Karl Rove's client, Bill Pryor, who was also the one who started the state investigation against me. Later, when I was governor in 98, I brought the suit against Exxon, again, with the reluctance of Karl Rove's client, the attorney general. As you know, as you pointed out, we won that case and got a huge judgment against Exxon for fraud. But what had happened in the meantime, beginning in around 1992 to 94 and then leading up through this case, Karl Rove had been hired by Bill Canary, who was the head of the business council and the husband of my prosecutor, to work in campaigns to unseat the Democrats, and basically they spent $5.5 million of campaign money to elect inexperienced members to the court, and they reversed this ruling. You know, again, how connected it is, I don't know, but the players are the same. It's Karl Rove, Bill Canary, the husband of my prosecutor, and me, and I think that there probably is a connection.
And you were the burr under the saddle of a whole lot of folks from ExxonMobil, but all of them seemed to converge on this Karl Rove and Jack Abramoff bunch. I mean, it's this, and now they've put restrictions on your ability to travel.
Well, they did. You know, the last time I was on this show, we were raising Cain about that because it had just happened that they had reclassified me as a special offender, which meant that I was placed in a category with the mafia and with potential terrorists. And as a result of that, my travel was greatly restricted. They have since that radio show, the Tom Hartman program, they have since retracted that classification and said it was a mistake. And so, theoretically, now I'm on the same travel restrictions as before, but I honestly don't know what those are because I haven't tested them yet. So we'll see how far I can go and without having a short leash on.
Right, and be able to get the message out. We're talking with former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. This could be the case. This even frankly bigger than Joe Wilson and Valerie Plame. This could be the case that could put, in my opinion, not speaking for you, Governor, that could put Karl Rove in jail and that could break open the corruption in the Bush White House in a way that is absolutely huge if Congress would only do it. If you want more information about this, Governor Siegelman will be taking your calls, your questions right after the break here. More information, check out his website, donsiegelman.org. Siegelman, I before E. Remember that from elementary school? Siegelman. Donsiegelman.org. Governor, you can stick around, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. We're 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back in a few minutes with your calls for Governor Don Siegelman of Alabama.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Do you know what you face?
Four minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. We have Governor Don Siegelman on the line, the former governor of Alabama, and the man whose persecution, I would say, as well as prosecution by Karl Rove and his buddies, my language, not his, may well break open one of the largest scandals, certainly in our history, going back to Watergate. Governor, before we take any phone calls here, anything you want to add to what we've said so far? By the way, I want to note for folks listening, your website is Don Siegelman, I-before-E-S-I-E-G-E-L-M-A-N.org. Anything you want to toss in?
Well, I think that, yeah, if anybody wants more information, they can go to the DonSiegelman.org website or DonSiegelman.com website. But I want to echo what you just said. I really believe that this case, once it starts to unfold, will make Watergate look like child's play, because it will expose so much more. And I want to make this clear. It's not about me or my case. I mean, my guilt or innocence will be decided by the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. I mean, I'm confident of the outcome of that. But what is important here is, again, the Congress digging in and discovering the truth so we can restore justice and restore our democracy. If Congress fails to act, nothing will have been done to prevent something like this from happening again. We've got to hold those people, Karl Rove and others, accountable and make it clear and unequivocal that we are not going to let this country slide back into this ever again.
Yeah. Amen. David in Atlanta, Georgia, you're on the air with Governor Don Siegelman.
Good afternoon, Governor. This is David Diaz. I had a question about the House Judiciary Committee requested that Karl Rove testify, and I was just curious, is there any legal means to make him testify rather than politely asking him? And is he trying to use executive privilege again? What is the way around that?
You were a former attorney general. You're a former prosecutor. You're an attorney, Governor Siegelman. Your thoughts?
Well, I think there is a way around his claim of executive privilege, and I believe that, first of all, Congress needs to move forward with subpoenaing Karl Rove and having him before the committee and going ahead and giving him a choice of pleading the Fifth Amendment and refusing to testify, or lying under oath or telling the truth, which I doubt he would ever do. But so I think probably what we'll see is a repeated claim of the Fifth Amendment when Rove appears before the committee. He has been given until May the 12th, as I understand it, to answer Chairman John Conyers' request that he appear voluntarily under oath. We will see, what he, will do. But, it was interesting to watch Karl Rove equivocate, because he had sent this, basically had said, his lawyer, Robert Luskind, had said, yes, he will testify. And,
yeah. To Dan Abrams on MSNBC.
Yeah, and then, of course, he backtracked on that real quick when John Conyers took him up on it. So, now I think Congress, hopefully will move forward and will require his testimony by way of a subpoena.
Yeah, and I think, by the way, I just a personal note here. I think Dan Abrams has done a marvelous job of publicizing this on MSNBC too, and Keith Olbermann as well. Ian, I don't have a city for you, Ian. I'm sorry. Tell us where you're located.
San Francisco.
Okay.
And good morning to both of you. What I wanted to suggest is something that I've called in and suggested to the committee a couple of weeks ago, and I wanted to get your reaction, Governor. I wouldn't even spend any more time about whether they'd let you travel there. Why not bring the committee hearing to Alabama and hold the hearing there and take your testimony? That would get a lot more publicity for it, and maybe the media would start covering this issue.
That is a good idea. Although most of the media here seems to be in a mode of not listening, and if they are listening, they're listening in disbelief to what is being said by the national media. But that is something that I think that the committee could consider, is having a hearing here. I think that what is to me what is important is that that we all write, email, or call Chairman John Conyers and Chairman Henry Waxman of the Government Oversight and Reform Committee and encourage them to continue their investigation into this. Congressman Waxman has taken on Jack Abramoff, and of course, one of the aspects of his investigation that I would like to see him pursue is investigating Abramoff's involvement in my election in 1998 and his involvement in the Alabama Education Lottery referendum in 1999 and his involvement in both my election and the election being stolen in 2002. And along with that, we have Karl Rove, we have Grover Norquist, we have Ralph Reed, all of those people participating, Ralph Reed in all three of those elections. Hmm. And nobody is investigating their involvement in money laundering in Alabama of Indian casino money through the Christian Coalition to defeat me and to defeat the lottery effort. It's a huge issue, and as I've said before, all roads lead to Rove. This investigation that Chairman Waxman is involved will lead to Rove as well. It's a question of whether John Conyers' investigation leads to Rove faster than Henry Waxman's investigation will lead to Waxman, lead to Rove. But they're both going to the same place.
Right. The phone number for Congress, by the way, is 202-225-3121. There are a number of toll-free numbers over at callcongress.org. And you can simply call Capitol Hill and ask for the office of John Conyers or Henry Waxman. Congressman Waxman and Conyers, and register your concern that this situation with regard to former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman be investigated. There's also information and contact information over at Don Siegelman, SIEI before E, donsiegelman.org. More information there. Len in New York City, you're on the air with Governor Don Siegelman.
Hi, thank you, and all the best of luck to you. You had just mentioned what I was about to ask you about. Jack Abramoff and Grover Norquist, Ralph Reed were all directly involved in your campaign. It would seem to me that Jack Abramoff is already, to some degree, I think as a result of some type of plea agreement, been forced to, help in any way that, with any type of inquiry. So he would be one of the first people to be called, I would assume. Could you comment on that?
Well, I think you're right. I think he obviously knows a lot, and of course, more is coming out about how Karl Rove and Jack Abramoff misused and abused power and influence to stymie investigations that might have been going on in the criminal division of the Department of Justice. We recently saw the resignation of Alice Fisher, who had ties with Abramoff, and also her deputy, Joseph Coughlin, I believe his name was, who had just entered a plea agreement for cooperating, for trading government actions for favors from Abramoff and Abramoff's employees. But there's so much more to be disclosed and so much more that needs to be investigated with regard to Abramoff and Rove's involvement in the abuse of power in the Department of Justice.
Amen. Sarah in Sebastopol, California, listening on Green 960 in San Francisco. Sarah, you're on the air with Governor Don Siegelman.
Thank you so much for taking my call, Tom. It's a privilege whenever I get to listen to your show.
Thank you.
And when I heard you mention, Governor Siegelman, that your election was turned over electronically, one of my pet issues is verifiable national voting. And I've signed all the petitions, written letters, and I'm just aghast that nothing seems to be happening to make sure that we have safe, verifiable elections in the States. What can we do to make this happen?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. We've got to move towards some kind of ballot.
Like go back to paper?
Well, I'm not so sure that we, you know, I would.
It
frankly,
works for Canada
would,
and all of Europe.
Frankly, I'd rather go back to paper ballots and be able to hand count them if we have to make sure that we have a winner in office. But you know, surely there's got to be another way. And of course, in our situation in Baldwin County, where it was a Republican county, and we had won enough votes in that county. We lost the vote in that county. We expected to lose the vote, but we won enough votes to win the election. Went to sleep, and after at midnight, when the poll workers were sent home, and the poll watchers were sent home, and the media was sent home, some people got together in the basement of the courthouse and electronically shifted the votes. And the next morning, we asked for a hand count of the paper ballots that were passed through the counter. And we were told that we could do that by the local officials, but then Karl Rove's client stepped in, the attorney general, and said anybody that tries to do that's going to jail. And again, the people responsible for ballot security in that county was one guy named Dan Gantz, who later went to work for Jack Abramoff and Tom DeLay's company, the Alexander Strategy Group. So,
that's amazing. We'll get back to that right after this, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program here on Air America Radio. 9.5 minutes before the hour, we're talking with Governor Don Siegelman of Alabama, former governor of Alabama. His website, Don Siegelman, I-B-4-E-C-S-I-E-G-E-L-M-A-N.org. And check it out. Our website, of course, TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, 866-303-2270, our telephone numbers. Governor, we got slammed by the commercial necessities of programming here. As you were wrapping up the story of how you essentially lost the election of 2002 or won it and it was taken from you, do you want to just quickly recap that and then we'll go on to our next caller?
Well, we won the election. The votes were electronically shifted by two people. One who was two people who either took credit or got credit for it. One was Karl Rove's partner. The other was a person who went to work for a Jack Abramoff, Tom DeLay related company. There's no doubt in my mind that the election was stolen. We tried to prove that by hand recount, but we were blocked by Karl Rove, a client who was then the Attorney General. And that's the story of the election, but what is at stake in this country today is our basic freedoms and whether or not we preserve our democracy. And Tom, your show, whether it's me or others who are on talking about this issue, you know, we've got to keep in mind that it's not about me or my case. Again, it's about this country and whether or not we're going to fight to get it back.
Yep.
And I want to commend you for what you've been doing to help give an expression to the voices out there around the country who want to say something and do something to get this country back to where it should be.
Well, thank you, sir. Without too much mutual admiration here, I want to commend you for, you know, going through hell and still coming back and fighting back. I mean, it's extraordinary. Let's get to our callers here. Christopher in Washington, D.C. Christopher, you're on the air with Governor Don Siegelman.
Hey. I want to say Tom, because you're so nice, I have to say it twice, Tom. Your show has been very inspirational to me, and I followed the story of Governor Siegelman. The Bush grip must be relaxing on this country's media, because 60 Minutes did a great job, I think, telling the story to those who didn't know about it before.
Right.
I worked as a little underling in the Clinton White House, and since Bush got in there, I haven't gone within 500 feet of the place. You know, Rove has been like a dark cloud over my home city. He's done numerous things around that, unfortunately, have often only been covered by the local press.
Amen. Chris, a question for the governor?
My question is, Governor, I don't suppose you have a chance of overturning this thing and, you know, running for governor again or being able to contend with this Republican. Is that a possibility?
Well, I think we will, the case will, I hope and trust, and that it will be overturned and reversed by the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. We'll find out within the next 8 months, I think. But I think really more importantly, regardless of what happens to me, the most important thing is for the people of this country to demand their country back, to demand our democracy back, to restore justice. And I think that starts with an expose that has to come from Congress.
they've got to keep digging for the truth to expose those people who are responsible for what has happened in this country. And we have got to hold them accountable and say clearly to everybody that might be thinking that they're going to do the same thing someday, that we're not going to tolerate it anymore. We've got to stop this. We've got to regain our country.
Amen. Judy in Orange County, California, listening on K-Talk in Los Angeles. Hey, Judy, you're live with Governor Don Siegelman.
Thank you, Tom, for taking my call. Governor Siegelman, I have a question. It concerns me that that Bush will pardon Roe on the way out. I was thinking maybe if they can string out this investigation until the election and then after the election, really go after Roe so Bush can't pardon him and get some kind of assurance from our next president that they won't pardon Bush. What is your opinion on that?
Well, I think that because Roe has been so linked to so many areas of wrongdoing, that any attempt to provide a pardon for him could appear to be an obstruction of justice. I think that what would be in the best interest of our President Bush is to let this thing go to the, you know, whichever way, you know, it's going to go. I just don't believe that he would issue a pardon of Roe before he leaves office. And again, what we've got to do is to encourage Congress to keep moving and move fast to, in case that they can uncover something before the end of this term.
Right. We just have a couple minutes left. Marion, South Carolina, quick question for Governor Don Siegelman.
Is that me?
That's you.
Oh, well, I sent a note to John Conyers this morning regarding Governor Siegelman, so I hope that's going to help. And I'd like to ask the governor, doesn't a congressional subpoena trump travel restrictions? And if not, can't he testify electronically right from his home base?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Governor, she asked if a congressional subpoena would trump travel the travel restrictions that had been imposed on you or any future ones that might be imposed on you. And if so, could you testify before Congress from Alabama?
Oh, yes. I think I will do whatever is necessary to provide Congress with whatever help and assistance I can provide them with that would further this investigation into Karl Rove's abuse of power.
Okay. We have just 1 minute left. We're talking with Governor Don Siegelman, the former governor of Alabama. Don Siegelman, SIEGELMAN.org is his website. Governor, in this last minute, do you want to give us a wrap-up, the thoughts that you'd like to share with the American people about this?
Well, Tom, the most important thing is that we keep talking about it. We have got to inspire and encourage Congress to keep digging for the truth. I want to say how much I appreciate Congressman John Conyers and Chairman Waxman's leadership on the two important issues. Also, Senator Arlen Specter has spoken out on this. He's a Republican who wants to clean the slate, clean house. He wants to set things right. So, this is important. Important to America, it's important that we restore justice and restore our democracy.
Yeah. Amen. Governor Don Siegelman, donsiegelman.org is his website. Please check it out. There's an enormous amount of information there. And we'll have a link to it from our homepage, tomhartman.com. Governor, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Keep up the great work. 57 minutes past the hour. Up next, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. At the bottom of the hour, Christy Harvey's going to drop by and say hi. And we will have talk radio news at the end of the hour. But in the first part of this hour, I'd like to get into the broader issue that's going on with regard to this primary. There's all this talk about, you know, is Hillary Clinton going to pull out? And if so, when? And if not, you know, how long is she going to fight? And should she be vice president or not? And et cetera, et cetera. And I think, frankly, an awful lot of this is one of those grand media distractions from the real issues. And fundamentally, the real issues that are being talked about, both by the Clinton campaign and by the Obama campaign, are not being covered. The main real issue being the economy. Now, you know, it may take a stunt, like calling for a gas tax, to highlight it, as Hillary Clinton tried to do in Indiana and North Carolina. It may take just trying to push through the media barrier. I mean, over and over and over again, Barack Obama would say, in response to questions about whether or not he wears a flag pin or something, you know, that's not what Americans are concerned about. They're concerned about whether they can fill their tank with gas. They're concerned about whether they can send their kids to college. They're concerned about whether they can pay for their medication or even their health insurance, or, you know, even with health insurance if they're going to get wiped out. These bottom line issues, these economic issues, this is at the core of it. Kevin Phillips blogging over at the top of Huffington Post right now, talking about how the consumer price index, you know, the government is telling us inflation is what, 3% more or less? Give me a break. The price of gasoline is up more than 200% since George Bush came into office. Food prices are rising. Rents are rising. Yeah, there is a housing crash, I guess, in many parts of the country, but it's not reflecting in the cost of living. The cost of credit is still incredibly high to anybody except the banks themselves, right across the board. And then you look at the distribution of wealth in the United States. We really have come back into a new gilded age. And this is why I think it's so important that we consider that the Obama campaign, and to a large extent the Clinton campaign as well, although they have been funding the campaign more with money from, quote, traditional sources, you know, PAC money and things like that. And Obama has been saying, no, we're not going to take that. But in both cases, both of these campaigns have been talking about the thing that John McCain will not talk about, that the Republicans won't talk about. McCain last night had a fundraiser, $7 million. People showing up, $100,000 apiece, bundling these contributions. He's doing the exact same thing George W. Bush did. John McCain with his 8 mansions around the world, around the country, doing the exact same thing of pulling together all this cash. If you go over to lcurve.org, there's a great riff on the distribution of wealth in the United States. And I want to share this is just a beautiful graphic, a visual, something you can imagine in your own head. Now, I just share this with you, and then right after the break, we'll take some calls, your thoughts on how we can all help bring the discussion of this election away from the stupidity and inanity of the horse race stuff. Oh, gee, who's going to pull out when, and when's it going to happen, and who's going to be the VP and all that? You know, frankly, that's the trivial and small stuff into the larger issues that have actually been raised by both the Clinton and the Obama campaigns, and before that, by the Edwards campaign and by the Biden campaign and by the Kucinich campaign and by the Dodd campaigns, right across the board, even the Mike Gravel campaign. LCurve.org. The U.S. population, if you think of the U.S. population as people, you know, standing along the length of a football field. Okay, so you've got people, you know, standing from one goalpost to the other all across the football field, and they're representing, and next to them are stacks of $100 bills representing their wealth. In the middle, at the 50-yard line, you have the median family income in the United States, about $40,000 a year. Stack of $100 bills would be 1.6 inches high. So at the 50-yard line, the people standing there have a stack of $100 bills, or the person standing there has a stack of $100 bills next to her that's 1.6 inches high, $40,000 a year. Then you go out to the 95-yard line. This would be the 95th percentile. The 95-yard line. We're only 5 yards from the end. The 95-yard line, that's the family that earns $100,000 a year. They have a stack of $100 bills that's 4 inches high. At the 99-yard line, the top 1%, that income is around $300,000 a year. They have a stack of $100 bills that's a foot high. So it's coming almost up to their shin, right? It's above their ankle, the 99-yard line, but it's not quite to their knees. And then you go from the 99-yard line to the goalpost. And when you get a couple inches from the goalpost, we're talking about the top 0.0001%. The curve 1 foot from the goalpost. First of all, 1 foot out. This is the 0.001%. 1 foot out from the goalpost. That's $1 million. That they have a stack of $100 bills that's 40 inches high. That's up to their waist. Okay, just a little bit above a person's waist. That's 1 foot from the goalpost. At the goalpost, the top wage earners in the United States, their income, their stack of $100 bills, goes 50 kilometers, 30 miles into the sky. That's how weird it is. I mean, we are literally in the new Gilded Age. This is how wealth was distributed in the United States in the 1880s, the 1890s, right up through the late 1920s. This is how wealth was distributed in the United States. The middle class was getting wiped out. As a result of it, you had the farmers organizing in the Grange movement. You had labor organizing all across the United States, people saying, hey, wait a minute, stop. And you had the forces pushing back, in many cases violently pushing back against the labor movement. People being murdered, Joe Hill, and on and on. I mean, you know, the stories that the Pullman strike, the Haymarket riots, you had the emergence of the Wobblies among the first unions, the International Workers of the World. And as people were saying enough already of this, you even had a Republican president, Teddy Roosevelt, 1901 to 1908, you even had a Republican president saying, we're going to take on these big corporations. So that in 1907, Teddy Roosevelt got a law passed through Congress that made it illegal for a corporation to contribute money to individual members, you know, people running for federal office, which, by the way, is still on the books. This is what Tom DeLay is being prosecuted for down in Texas. Many states still have this law as well. They do in Texas. Tom DeLay, the darling of the... It just blows my mind to see him on TV as if he's like, oh... They never introduce him as indicted felon Tom DeLay, corrupt politician, former politician Tom... No, it's always GOP party elder. Well, that's because the GOP is the party of that last inch next to the goalpost, where the stack of $100 bills doesn't come up to their ankles as it does at the 50-yard line, doesn't come up to their shins as it does at the 90-yard line, doesn't come up to their waist as it does at the 99-yard line. It comes up to the, it's 30 miles high, that stack of $100 bills. And this isn't about, oh, gee, isn't that terrible? A few people are incredibly wealthy in this country. Now, what happens when this happens, you know, what happens to a society when wealth is this unevenly distributed in the society, is you end up with a class of essentially the landed gentry. It becomes like Dickens' England. You know, the story, Dickens' story, The Christmas Carol, where you had Ebenezer Scrooge and his partner Bob Marley, his partner Marley, who was dead. His partner was... Scrooge was not the upper class. He wasn't the wealthy. Scrooge was the middle class. He was a small businessman. And then you had Bob Cratchit coming to him. Bob Cratchit was the working poor. He represented the vast majority, the 90% or more of British society. And he was like, please, Mr. Scrooge, may I have a lump of coal? My hands are cold. No, you may not. It'll cost me an extra pence. Well, how about health care for my son, Tiny Tim? No, you may not. The stories of Dickens. Dickens' father was thrown into debtor's prison. I mean, Dickens understood this. That's the era that we are now revisiting in the United States, and that it frankly is starting to happen in parts of Western Europe, as they're adopting what is referred to in Europe as neoliberalism, as what we call in the United States Reaganomics or conservative economics, right-wing economics, whatever you want to call it, Friedmanomics, whether it's Thomas or Milton. These sort of economic policies destroying the middle class, destroying the working class of America, and creating a vast and, in the minds of the people who are doing it, hopefully politically impotent class of folks who are not going to speak out, who are not going to rise up, and instead are just, you know, they're working three jobs. They don't even have time to watch the news to discover that the news isn't news anymore. It's infotainment because it's been taken over by the billionaires and the corporations that are used to aggregate wealth. How do we fix this? Well, you do what Franklin Roosevelt did. You say, okay, you make more than $3.2 million a year, 91% income tax. Let's roll back the Reagan tax cuts.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Rachel in Palm Beach, Florida, listening on Wind.
Well, hey, what an honor to talk to you.
Well, thank you for calling. What's up?
You are the most. I cannot understand how they can talk about Rush Limbaugh on the TV, and his name is in the paper. I think it's tantamount to what Joe McCarthy would call the overthrow of the United States government.
Yeah. Well, at the very least, it should be condemned, in my opinion, as being immoral to be tampering with elections. This is just
isn't it illegal?
Not celebrated. Well, his encouraging it is, well, technically, I suppose in some states it could be illegal. It is a crime in some states to change your election affiliation or to mess with the elections, basically, for purely partisan purposes. And I believe it's a crime in Pennsylvania. I know it is a crime in several states. And so arguably, Limbaugh could be prosecuted for encouraging the commission of a crime in those states. The fact of the matter is, though, that this is something that's been going on forever. I grew up in Michigan, and I remember the Republicans crossing over, because we have open primaries in Michigan, the Republicans crossing over and voting for George Wallace back in whatever year that was. I think it was 78 or something like that. And embarrassing the Democratic Party by getting George Wallace as the nominee for the Democratic candidate for president. That was not the will of the Democrats in that state. And more recently, there was a very weak Republican candidate for governor. And so they on the Democratic side, they got the attorney for Jack Kevorkian, you know, Dr. Death. They got him on the ballot as the Democratic candidate. Republicans crossing over. It was a very well-organized effort. And it's been very well-documented in Michigan and other states as well.
But it wasn't. It's not only that. He said he was promoting a riot.
Oh yeah, that little matter. Yes,
he
backpedaled from that, you know. But it's still. I agree with you, Rachel. I think it's an absolute shame. And I thank you for calling and pointing it out. But it's, you know, what can we say? What can I say? All Americans who love this country should point out that somebody who loves this country would not wish riots on this country. Somebody who loves this country would not want to mess with the electoral system in this country. What this says is that Rush Limbaugh hates America, which I think is fairly evident and has been for a long time, and that many people on the Reich basically hate this country. They hate what this country stands for. They want an aristocracy of, by, and for multimillionaires and billionaires, period. And they basically just hate the rest of us. Lakshmi in Oakland, California. Hey, Lakshmi.
Hi there, Tom. It's Lakshmi.
Thank you.
You were asking about what can we do when the conversation gets negative.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I want to follow Barack Obama. You know, he, when things got really heated and nasty against him and mean against him, he stayed on the high road. So what I see that I can do, and it won't be really easy, but when the conversation gets negative, just take it back to the high road and what Barack can do for our country and what I am, as a citizen, committed to for our country, because I do love our country. And I think that what we've been through in the last 8 years has been, you know, horrendous. And we need to move forward. And even I'm just reading a thing right here that Barack has issued a directive to his supporters to be respectful of Mrs. Clinton and her supporters in the days ahead. So he's leading
Amen.
The way.
Amen. And frankly, I shouldn't be ranting about how Limbaugh hates America, because that's their meme. Lakshmi, thank you so much for the call. Well, let me ponder that one for a minute. But excellent point. Ron in Vermont. Hey, Ron.
Hi. I just want to say that you're going to have Bernie on tomorrow, and there was an article by him, by Rich Tarrant, his opponent in the senatorial race here in Vermont, about how Vermont is so unkind to businesses, and he was dissing Bernie. And I just want to credit you for, you know, my reply on the blog, for giving me some information to fight with. That came from Ravi Batra.
Yeah.
And what I try to do these days is the three I's, I call it, which is first identify the people or the organization, then isolate them, and then inoculate myself from them through getting educated. And I just want to thank you and the liberals for giving me the information to fight back.
There you go. Ron, you're welcome. Thank you very much for the call and for speaking out. Jeff in Portland, Oregon. About a half a minute, Jeff.
Thanks, Tom. I wanted to let you know that the reason the right-wing reactionaries are so vociferous in this meddling with elections, whether or not they've done it before, this time they're desperate. They know the change is written on the wall, and the change is coming this fall. They're desperate. That's why they're trying this Operation Chaos or whatever it is.
Yeah, in fact, and that point should be made, is that the essence of Operation Chaos is we can't win by talking, or they're saying essentially that they can't win by talking about the real issues. They can't win by talking about what Americans want, because the vast majority of Americans want strong Social Security. They want a national health care system. They want clean air and water. They want the corporations to be paying their fair share of taxes rather than 7% of the national tax load. And they can't, you know, they can't win on the issues. So they're going to mess with the elections. 27 minutes past the hour. Christy Harvey up next.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Be careful of what you say. Be careful in every way. Be careful of what you do. Big Brother is watching you. Be circumspect and discreet. Stay light on your mental feet. One slip and you know you're through. Big Brother is watching you. Conform with all directives. Remember, obedience pays. That TV screen, remember, it works both ways.
Don't you know? And if it's not the TV, it's the pigeons. I'm telling you, look out. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. And Christy Harvey, the Director of Strategic Communications for the Center for American Progress and the editor of the daily radio prep site, MikeCheckRadio.org, is on the line with us. Hey, Christy.
Hey, that's the best song yet. I like that one.
Yeah, Louise comes up with some real winners.
That's great. It had sort of a Grinch Who Stole Christmas feel to it.
There you go. Yeah.
Love it. How are you?
I am great. How about you?
Fantastic. I'm doing quite well.
Wonderful, wonderful. So the Mustache of Justice and Henry Waxman and his oversight committee, they were going to finally have their chance to confront the head of the EPA, Stephen Johnson, this guy who's been so slippery, shall we say.
Okay, that's a nice way of putting it.
Yeah, and even, you know, he has a hard time testifying because he's got to do things like go to Australia and stuff, but now he's got a brand new excuse.
I can't believe, and you called this one. When I first told you that he was scheduled to testify in front of Waxman's committee this week, you said he'll get out of it. And I said, no, he can't get out of this one. He's got to go. There's no way he can get out of it. So he was supposed to testify today, and 2 days ago, actually, his office called Henry Waxman's office and said, here's the thing, Stephen Johnson can't testify in front of your committee about all the bad stuff he's been doing recently because his back hurts. His
poor
back
guy.
Hurts.
Let's get him a massage therapist. Maybe David Vitter knows one.
Good idea. No, he was in a car accident a few years ago, and they said that every once in a while, like when he has to testify, he will get some back pain. Yeah. But this would have actually, I might have had a little bit more compassion for the guy had he not, like you said, gotten out of the last time he was supposed to face tough questioning in front of Barbara Boxer's committee in the Senate last month. He called up 2 days before and said, yeah, here's the thing, I can't go because I'm going to Australia for a couple of weeks. So, yeah.
Well, you know, those first-class airline seats are actually supposed to be good for your back. They've got little back massagers built into them, so maybe that was the thing. You know, it's needs and in fact, maybe he'll be on an airplane. By the way, where was this? In Indiana, speaking of Indiana, as we all have been doing for the last couple of days, Tony Zirkle, this guy who this Republican who campaigned at a Nazi rally real Nazis, you know, with
real
swastikas,
Nazis,
great big photo of Adolf Hitler on his birthday. He lost, as we might have predicted, but there's a kicker to this story.
Yeah, I was actually pretty surprised. His primary, of course, was also on Tuesday, and this guy, I mean, he stood in front of a Citizen Kane-sized picture of Adolf Hitler and gave a speech to the Hitler Youth, and it got out, and he still got 16% of the vote. Are these people?
They're Republicans.
I'm reading this article that he got trounced and he only got 16%, and I thought, no, there's no only about this. 16% right. Is way too much.
Yeah, that's very strange. So, speaking of the Reich, I have a photo in our studio here. One of our listeners sent to us of a guy in an SS uniform with the SS logo next to it, and only the face is Dick Cheney, and it fits in perfectly. Cheney, David Addington, is supposed to testify in front of Congress on June 26th. Do you think he's going to have a bad back?
I don't think that. Maybe he'll have a stomach ache or come down with a good flu. No, he's actually said that if he were subpoenaed, he'd come testify. And I am so excited I can hardly see. It's June 26th, and this David Addington, I had forgotten just how diabolical he is. His nickname, I'm not making this up, his nickname is actually Kaiser Sose, like the devil in The Usual Suspects. He is behind the scenes of almost every bad thing this administration has done. He's the guy who created the whole military tribunal system. He's the guy who, his protégés are William Haynes and you, the guys who wrote the torture
John
memos.
Not you.
John Yoo. He basically drafted and helped craft those torture memos. He's the guy who was involved in the Valerie Plame leak. He was the guy who signed off and created the warrantless wiretapping idea. He's the guy who came up with the idea of using all the signing statements to ignore laws. He's that guy. And he usually doesn't speak. And he's usually very low-key and undercover. John Conyers has subpoenaed him, and if all goes well, he'll be there June 26th.
I wonder if he played any role in the whole Don Siegelman thing. We had the governor on for an hour here just 39 minutes ago, and it's absolutely astounding
what's
going on
down in Alabama.
It
really wouldn't. The only thing I can't seem to tie him to is Katrina, but everything else that's gone down, he is involved in somehow, some way.
Now, speaking of the right, E.J. Dionne, Dionne, the Washington Post columnist, has a new book out, Sold Out, S-O-U-L-E-D,
right.
Out. And he's pointing out that the reliable good buddies of the hard right, which have been the Ted, what's his name, and the Jerry Falwells and, you know, the whole bunch, I mean, you know, Falwell running around with his...
You got to kill the terrorists before the killing stops. And I'm for the president. Chase them all over the world. If it takes 10 years, blow them all away in the name of the Lord.
I mean, this kind of stuff...
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Wow, I hadn't heard that.
Well, you know, rest
in the name
soul.
Of the Lord. Man.
Right. And a lot of folks on the right, the evangelicals... In fact, let me rephrase that. A lot of evangelicals are reevaluating their association with the right.
Absolutely. And E.J. Dionne's book is phenomenal. I'm obsessed with this thing right now. And it really goes through the death of the religious right, how it came to power and why it has really lost power, especially since 2004. And reading it, you know, it made a lot of good points. And then yesterday, it turns out he's actually really onto something. And yesterday, a coalition of more than 70 U.S. evangelical leaders banded together and signed off on what they're calling the Evangelical Manifesto, which is basically saying we no longer want to be associated with one political party or another. We are interested as Christians, as evangelical Christians, in more than gay marriage and abortion. You can't keep taking us for advantage of us and relying on our votes based on those issues. We're also really concerned about things like poverty, like global warming. And this manifesto basically said, from now on, we are not going to politicize our faith. And it was a big deal. It's a big deal because, you know, especially since the 80s and the moral majority first started to come together, you say evangelical, and I know in my head and in most people's heads, you automatically think right-wing Republican. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, not anymore. We're really going to step away from the political movements, and we're really going to step away from the Republican Party.
I don't know if E.J. gets into it in his book, but the thing that I remember from the tail end of the Reagan administration, the early years of the Bush administration, is that the guy who was assigned the job when George Bush Sr. was running for president, the guy who was assigned the job of creating a liaison with the religious right to turn the religious right into part of the Republican political machine was George W. Bush.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is that's what he did for a year. He was, for the year running up to the election of whatever year that would be, when George W. Bush or George Herbert Walker Bush became president. So that would have been, 88? That year, running up to that election, for almost an entire year, George W. Bush was on the road traveling around to evangelical churches all over the United States, speaking in those churches, and most importantly, creating political liaisons with the major leaders and in those churches and the major and the political right. He essentially created the association between the hard right politically and the religious right.
Well, that's fascinating. And yeah, and one of the things EJ's book does touch upon is not only, you know, the ways like that, I didn't know that particular fact, but the ways that the Republicans really got the evangelicals on their side. But he also touches a little bit on what Democrats haven't done to reach out, and how Democrats are sometimes a little freaked out by religion and don't do, you know, don't address concerns of the religious faithful.
Yeah, and I think, you know, hallelujah. I'm glad to see people of faith in this country saying enough already. We're tired of being taken for granted, and we're tired of being used as political pawns. Vito Fasella, am I pronouncing that right, of New York?
Vito Fasella.
This kind of seems like a local story for New Jersey folks. He's the Republican from New Jersey. But
it's
going to get some national play. This is a salacious story.
I think he's actually from New York. I'm afraid I have a typo on my notes. But he got a DUI last week, and everybody was very interested in it around here. And he was in a D.C. bar, and they got kicked out because they were so drunk, and he got in a taxi, then got out of the taxi and drove himself. But now it turns out that he was driving himself to his mistress's house to visit his daughter that he had with, his three-year-old toddler daughter that he had with his mistress. And his wife found out when she wasn't the one called to bail him out, and it's all exploded in his face. Should be another Republican sex scandal. Very interesting.
Yeah, they just keep on coming.
They really do, one a week.
Yeah. Christy Harvey, the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, MikeCheckRadio.org. Christy, great talking with you always.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for dropping by. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. And Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, I'm going to have to interrupt you for just a minute and a half or so, somewhere in the middle of this your news report in all probability this afternoon. But first of all, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Hi. Great to have you with us. What's going on in Washington, D.C.? Our news from TalkRadioNews.com today.
Well, as far as the president's concerned, he's just left for Crawford because his daughter Jenna is getting married. And in the morning gaggle, there were only two topics of conversation and two different topics you couldn't possibly get. They were talking both about the marriage, and they were talking about the disaster in Myanmar and whether our aid is getting in or not. And the update on that is that a couple of United Nations flights have got in, but we still are not getting in. And those were the two things that are being discussed. But the talk in Washington is only about the Democratic primary. That is all anybody is talking about.
Let me just ask you a very quick question about Myanmar. I have noticed that 100%, I watch BBC News every night, and 100% of their references to that country have been to Burma.
Yes.
Here we're calling it Myanmar. I thought that our government was not recognizing it officially and was continuing to call it Burma. What's going on?
Well, it depends who you talk to, and it also depends which newspaper you talk to. I mean, the New York Times calls it Myanmar, and the Washington Post calls it Burma. The White House calls it Burma.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Interesting.
So, it sometimes I call it Burma, sometimes I call it Myanmar.
Yeah, yeah.
I go backwards and forwards.
So you said all of the discussion in Washington, D.C. is centered around what's going on with the Democratic primary. What are the dimensions of it that are the primary focus of the discussion?
The conversation really seems to be about a couple of things. One is, how much damage has she done to the party?
Hillary Clinton?
Hillary Clinton.
Well, the flip side of that is, how much good has she done to the party by staying in the race this long and getting millions of people registered in states all across the country?
And it's interesting that that is not very much a part of the conversation. And I think that's an interesting aspect of it in and of itself, that is not a part of the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I'm seeing right now here in Portland, Oregon, we have our primary on the 20th of May, and people are excited. People are excited. You know, it's coming to town. It is coming to town.
I think that will become a part of the conversation closer to November, when every member of the House comes up for election and they realize how many more Democrats are going to be around to vote for them than have been available before. But right now, that's not what they're talking about. But what they really are talking about is when, not if, she's going to get out.
Right. Okay. Chris, I'll need a two-minute cue. And other things around the world right now, Victoria.
Nobody's talking about anything else that's going on around the world.
It's all so the damage that Hillary Clinton has done. Anything else with regard to the Democratic primary? Victoria, we lost Victoria. Oh my goodness. Well, Dr. Mark Espinosa is with us. Central Dental Care is his service, and every week we try to feature one of our local advertisers. And Dr. Espinosa is a dentist in Phoenix. 9315 North Central Avenue, and you advertise on KPHX. Dr. Espinosa, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Tell me about what we like to do with these segments is, you know, feature the advertiser for a moment, and then also talk about the results that you're getting by advertising on Progressive Talk Radio, and encourage other potential advertisers on our stations all across the country to say, gee, I ought to be advertising on local Progressive Talk Radio. Tell us about your practice first.
Well, our practice is we do some bread and butter dentistry, and we also do cosmetic dentistry. And I've invested heavily in technology to make everything much more enjoyable and much more easy and comfortable for the patients. Mm-hmm. At Central Dental Care, we understand that we're not the center of everyone's universe. And we kind of, you know, listen to the patient, what they want, listen to their needs, what's kind of going on in their life, and making sure and seeing if dentistry fits in their life, and we go from there. And then from there, we build plans customized to each person.
That's great. Are cowards welcome in your practice?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Cowards, you know, I'm a coward. I know how it is to sit in the chair.
Yeah.
So I make sure I make it as gentle as possible. My staff is super friendly, really professional. And, you know, we treat everybody with kid gloves. And, you know, some people are cowards. Some people just, hey, just, you know,
that's
open
great.
My mouth, let it get it done, and let's go, you know.
There you
so,
go. And
yeah.
and you have been advertising on KPHX, our progressive station, our progressive affiliate there in Phoenix, Arizona.
That's right.
And what kind of results have you gotten?
Great results. Yeah, I encourage all small businesses or large businesses or in-between businesses to definitely advertise on their progressive mouthpiece.
Mm-hmm.
It's been very, very, the return on investment's been very, very good. The people that I meet are really, really nice and really cool, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I really feel if we want our progressive voice to be heard and to be, you know, on, then we need to all kind of look at the progressive stations as a way to increase our business and also spread the word on,
right,
you know, what's going on.
But it's been a good business decision for you.
Oh, absolutely. It's been a really good business decision.
Great.
You know, where else do you get to, you know, rub shoulders with celebrities like yourself, you know, Tom Hartman, and need I say, you know, mention your name, but also, you know, Randy Rhodes, you know, so that you get this really cool opportunity to meet really cool people, the listeners, and then also meet the actual voices, the actual minds behind the mic.
That's great. Dr. Mark Espinosa, his practice, Central Dental Care in Phoenix. And thank you, sir, for supporting Progressive Talk Radio.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and I feel like it's my obligation.
Yeah, good talking with you.
And all right, take care, Tom. Thank you.
Thank you. Central Dental Care on Central Avenue. Coming up tomorrow, if it's Friday, it's Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders drops by to tell us what's going on, what's really going on in Washington, D.C. Plus, it's your chance to talk to a real U.S. senator and get your questions asked and answered. Of course, the best of the rest of the news and your calls. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there. Get active. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.